Ciao, and welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast, a dialogue about how space technology and exploration are transforming our solar system.
Noah, we're delighted to have you here today on the Frontier Space Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. How are things in Edinburgh?
They're absolutely fine, yeah. Typical Scottish weather today, so a bit of sunshine, a bit of rain, a bit of everything. Everything is very good. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been raining over here in Strasbourg, France, for the past few days or so as well. Love to dive in and hear more about your background and research, if you could share.
Yeah, so much. So I work for the UK Astronomy Technology Centre in Edinburgh, where we design instruments for ground-based astronomy and also for space-based astronomy. So we're involved in projects with an extremely large telescope, which will be being built in Chile. So we're building a big instrument, first light instrument called Harmony, and we're also involved in the Webb Space Telescope. Our director is actually the PI of one of the three instruments there. And we also have a big involvement in an instrument called LISA. And I personally do something called adaptive optics. So it's basically trying to correct optical distortions in an active way, so having an active control about the optical quality. On the ground, it's due to atmospheric turbulence. In space is more either vibrations or optical distortions due to thermal effects or other variations. So that's what I do. I did start a career in Paris, in France, and an institute called ONERA, where I did adaptive optics for laser communication, where you need to compensate the laser beam to make sure it goes at the other end of the receiver. And then I switched institutes again near Paris in Meudon, Paris Observatory, to do a postdoc, and then I moved across to Edinburgh in the UK to work for the UK Astronomy Technology Centre. So I've been based there for quite a while now. And as I said, working on ground-based astronomy a lot, and also in space instrumentation.
Excellent. What was your aha moment that really inspired you to pioneer this research on deployable mirrors and CubeSats?
Well, I don't know if there was an aha moment, but it was more of a gradual understanding of the issues and trying to imagine solutions. And just discussed briefly about the James Webb Space Telescope. So that's one of a very good flagship instrument for astronomy. It's ginormous. It's 6.5 meters in diameter. Took many decades to develop. And that is using deployable mirrors to have a bigger aperture, basically, and be able to fit in the fairing of the rocket. So that was their idea, really. How can we fit this humongous mirror in a rocket? So they decided to fold it so it can fit, and obviously unfold it in space. But since that, this started 20 years ago or so, there hasn't been any other real examples of deployable optics. First of all, because it's quite hard. And second of all, the costs are just not doable for a normal company. There's multi-partner, multi-country, multiple countries investing in that facility. So, but there are some fundamental reasons why you want a bigger aperture. And they're basically the same for all the applications, either Earth observation or astronomy. You need a bigger telescope to have more photons, more surface area to collect light, but also have a bigger telescope to have a sharper image, so you can see more details in the image, For astronomy, you can distinguish between different objects, or for the ground, you can image objects of smaller and smaller objects. So basically that, but because of the technical challenges it wasn't possible to take that technology and say, oh, let's look at the Earth, or let's look at, make it cheap for a university to develop or other companies to do. There are other ideas out there to make a bigger aperture, but basically the technological readiness level is not there. It's sort of like a nice idea on paper, and they did a few funny lab experiments, but then taking that to space is quite a challenge. So really the James Webb concept seems to be the one that's quite solid and doable, and they're obviously hopefully going to fly to October this year, so a few more months and we'll see. I think that the shift has been the event of the CubeSats really is like, all right, this is a cheap way for commercial companies to buy into space and develop their own little widgets or software to analyze the data. And that really combining these two ideas of having a cheap platform and quite high-end technology in the end, combined, that was sort of the drive initially. And it's really putting these two ideas together, trying to make it feasible. And we have a lot of history and expertise in making complex optical systems work. It's not an aha moment. I think it's years of maturation. I'm not sure you can say years of maturation is an aha moment, but maybe it is. Maybe that's what really happens.
But yeah, most people didn't connect the dots like you did. So you were the lead author on a recent study on a potentially game-changing idea for a CubeSat. So could you elaborate more specifically on the concept and kind of the core innovation?
So yeah, I'll talk first about a bit more about CubeSats. So CubeSats are sort of standardized satellite platforms that have certain dimensions, for example, and they refer as these dimensions as units. So 1U is about 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And you can add them together. So you have 1U telescopes, 3U telescopes, 6U, 12U, etc. The most common nowadays being 3, 6, 12. So a quite famous company now is called Planet, and they use a constellation of many satellites. They keep sending up more and more up there. And so they use mostly 3U CubeSats. So the standard part is quite interesting for us, because it means we don't have to develop the whole platform. There are standard parts you can buy from different companies and different vendors. And you don't have to think too much of, how am I going to do the navigation, or how am I going to do the attitude control? It's all given within certain characteristics and standards. So this is quite useful. It's not really common, I think, in space to have standards like that, to that extent. And there's lots of different vendors now. And so that's one aspect of the concept, trying to be as standard as possible to match this CubeSat standard. On the other, it's the concept is actually quite simple, to be honest. It's you want to have a very large mirror in the end, in space. And what you do to fit the volume, so as I said, these volumes are standard, and they're mostly standard for the launch. You need to fit within that volume during the launch. So we fold these mirrors, which we call either segments or petals, a bit like a flower. So it's folded and fits within the volume of the CubeSats, and you launch it. And in space, you deploy, again, a bit like a flower. And you hope that they go into position, but we know they don't actually, because there's so much you can do in terms of mechanical precision when you deploy a bit of optic. Typical precisions are of the order of a few microns, or the thickness, the diameter of a hair, maybe a bit better. But we want to do images in the optical portion of the spectrum. So that's visible between the blue and red that we can see by eye. So we need to make sure the mirrors are aligned respective to the perfect shape, maybe to 20 nanometers. So that is a fraction of the diameter of the hair. So we can't do that mechanically. So we need to do an optical measurement. So taking an image, for example, of a star, we sort of know what a star should look like, and we move the mirrors into position. So there's two aspects. Well, first the folding of the mirror. That's, it's quite a challenge to package everything because of this very tight volumes, and then accurately deploy it to microns. That's the first stage. So that is a difficult mechanical feat to actually do. And then you have to control these positions. So you move the mirrors up and down, and you tip them so they basically form form a single optical surface. So we use actuators that we can actually buy from suppliers. And obviously have to test that they're the right ones. They're quite hard to find and to integrate on an instrument. And then we use some algorithms combined with the data we gather from the detector to find the optimal position. So that's the basic concept. So there are a few difficulties and hurdles along the way.
Excellent. In your study, you mentioned a lot about the challenges with the traditional deployment method of CubeSats and how that restricts the size of the optical apertures to a few centimeters and limits the ground sampling distance.
So basically with, that's if you call a monolithic mirror that are not segmented and not deployed, so the traditional way, it's almost like the unique way to do things in the moment. You're limited by the physical size of your CubeSat. So basically an aperture of say 9 to 10 centimeters. And that defines the ground sampling distance. So it's basically to simplify the size of the pixel on the ground you can image. So if you have an object that's 5 meters by 5 meters, and your ground sampling distance is 5 meters, basically you have all this object in one pixel, so you don't have any spatial information. And if you want more pixels, more information, more details in the image, then you need either to come closer, and that's very difficult because as soon as you come closer, then the satellite doesn't stay very long in orbit. So that's one way to do it. Some people are actually actively looking at having very, very low Earth orbit satellites. Basically what we do when we take a picture with our phone, if it's not big enough, either we zoom, but most likely we come closer. And we decided to have a bigger aperture. So that's another way to increase the resolution, is just have a bigger aperture. And we aiming at 30 to 40 centimeters. So basically, tripling or multiplying by 4 the aperture, so we have that resolution increase linearly. So for a 10 centimeter aperture, let's say the resolution is 3 meters on the ground, and by tripling that dimension, we have 1 meter on the ground. And actually 1 meter in the ground is actually really good compared to even much bigger platforms, and is quite a sweet spot, we believe, for a lot of applications of interest for people looking at the ground, basically.
I mean, that's incredible that there alone you can triple the spatial resolution of these satellite images and with CubeSats. And you so you conducted this experiment and ran something like 500 tests on the deployment of the mirrors.
Yeah, so that was a prototype we developed, sort of a proof of concept, rather, where we, this idea, is, as I said earlier, it's been around for more than 20 years, and it's not really a novel idea in itself. It's always combining ideas together that adds value, I think. And we wanted to make sure we actually knew how to move these optics, fold them and deploy them. So we did, 500, actually multiply by the number of mirrors we have. In previous design, we had four mirrors, and we're trying to simplify that to two. Obviously, having less deployable mirrors of bits bigger size, then you know, it simplifies and reduce the complexity. So yeah, we did a lot of lab experiments in that for that. So we deployed that optic, and as I said, there's only a certain amount of precision you can do mechanically when you deploy. So we folded these petals, folded inside the CubeSat, and deployed them using our deployment mechanism hundreds of times, and measured the accuracy of deployment. And we're actually quite pleased with that, because they were within 5 microns of our requirement. That is actually quite good, I have to say, especially in a CubeSat. Obviously, there's more to that, and there are more tests we need to run to ensure that we can do that in the right environment, etc. But it was a very convincing proof of concept.
Awesome. And we're curious to hear more about the future tests and when you plan to build and launch and deploy CubeSats in orbit.
Yeah, so that was, as I said, the proof of concept. We finished that. And now we're in second phase. We're trying to further develop this concept. So it's started about 6 months ago. We have another 2 years to go on that project. And the project is really to bring this proof of concept to more prototype stage, where we have a more complete demonstration of our instrument. So in that phase, we're working with our industrial partners here in Scotland. A company called Clyde Space. And they're really good, because it gives us an insight of actually what a company like them can actually deliver on a CubeSat. We always make assumptions and things we think is right, but talking to the right people and people with decades of experience is really valuable for us. So we're trying to increase the technology level of this entire mission, not just the deployment mechanism. So so for the moment, we decided on a certain size of platform. We think that's the sweet spot for our applications. So it's a 6U platform. So basically, it's 10 by 20 by 30 centimeters. And we want to deploy two large petals to reach that 30 centimeter aperture. But there's all other things to consider. In our proof of concept, we sort of went over very quickly. We want to make sure that we can fit within that restrictive volume. Before it was sort of proof of concept, so we didn't care so much about the volume. Now we care very much about the volume. There's also in a telescope at least two mirrors. There's the primary mirror, that's the collecting area, the one that's 30 centimeters, and then there's a secondary mirror that folds that light back onto a detector. And we need to put that aperture quite far away as well, typically 30 centimeters, 40 centimeters away from the primary mirror. In the CubeSat, it's more than the size of the CubeSat typically, so we need to deploy that as well. So we put a lot of effort in deploying that small mirror, but it's quite far away, almost like on a selfie stick, basically, quite far away. And we want to make sure, not like a selfie stick, that it doesn't move at all when we're taking images. And most importantly, we need to baffle that to make sure that light coming from unwanted areas are not illuminating the detector. So that is sort of the optical and mechanical design. We're designing that, and we will we've just started actually on the design. So so hopefully it will go well, and at the end of this phase, we'll have a demonstrator in the lab again, but with the right size and the right optics. And, so it'll be that technology pushed a bit further. And as I discussed earlier, once we deploy, and we know we can deploy, we need to demonstrate as well that we can control the optics with the sufficient accuracy to make sure that we can take images with the 1 meter ground sampling distance we advertise. So that's falls maybe on the umbrella called active or adaptive optics. And that's my remit of research. So we're conducting research here as well to make sure we can cope with the conditions of space and the image quality we have to have the final optical quality. So this is the second sort of branch of our current developments to try to achieve and have the right algorithms basically to do that. So hopefully at the end of these 2 years, we'll be in a strong position to actually have an in-orbit demonstrator. So you were asking that, where are your plans to go to space? Well, that's, you know, at the end of this project, we will not be in a position to go to space. We'll have a demonstrator for the ground, but that would be for the next stage of the project. And then probably another 2 or 3 years after that, then we'll be ready to launch a demonstrator and proof of concept.
Awesome. Really exciting. We'll definitely be, you know, looking out for as things develop and get closer to the launch day. I was wondering.
There's still a lot of engineering and science to go into that, but hopefully, yeah, as soon as we can.
Yes. Was wondering how much payload volume does your deployment method recover?
The typical 6 UCubeSat is divided by between the payload and the rest of the bus. It's typically 4U volume for the payload and 2 for the rest. Everything is negotiable in instruments in space, but you know, that's the typical sort of volume allocation we have. So we have to make sure everything fits. Although it's 6U CubeSat, we actually have two-thirds of that to build our instrument and our platform. So these mirrors are actually quite big, quite large. And a lot of this volume is taken by these mirrors, but also the mechanical structure that holds them into position. So that is basically a bit, two-thirds of a U, to use the CubeSat standard units of a U. And then we have actuators, and they're quite small, like a small matchbox, the smaller version. So they're quite smaller, small, even smaller. And we only need a few of them, 3 per segment. And then we have all the rest, the electronics and the detector itself. So we want to have a very large detector to gather the largest image possible. And that takes a lot of volume and data. So 4U, 4U volume for the rest of the payload. And as you can imagine, super, super tight to fit everything in and package it nicely. It wouldn't be so much of a problem if you weren't aiming for optical resolution, tens of nanometers of deployment accuracy in the end. So that's the real challenge. And I think that has been the issue so far of why people weren't trying to do that. It's just quite difficult technically, and we have the luxury of doing that every day for ground-based astronomy. So things are different, but we can take our heritage and our experience from there to transfer across.
Wonderful. Could we use and apply this method with ground-based telescopes, but also radar and SAR imaging satellites?
So good points about ground-based astronomy. Although the deployment wouldn't be necessarily on the ground, just have to build it already deployed. It's very hard to make a very large mirrors. When I say very large, is more than 8 to 10 meters. They're very large on the ground. So after the very large telescope in Chile, which was about 8 meters in diameter, we decided that going further was just impossible. The mirrors were too floppy and they would break or wouldn't produce the right optical surface. So basically we use what we call segmented telescopes. So we build mirrors maybe a meter in diameter that we typically in hexagons that we stick together, close together, and we form that optical surface with multiple mirrors. So basically, it is the same sort of idea, although we don't deploy, so we have an extra difficulty there. We do have to co-phase them, so they act as a single optical surface. So there are a couple ground-based telescopes, quite big ones, 8-10 meters, the Keck telescopes, also SALT in South Africa. There's lots of experience on the ground, so that's something we're doing. And for the extremely large telescopes as well, they have to be segmented. Their diameters at 40 meters across, so that's would be just impossible to carry and to make. So we have lots and lots of segments. So it's entirely the same concept there. And your second point was about radio, I suppose, radio waves, and it is slightly different than the radio. You have the luxury of being it's not the same wavelength, so actually you can do things slightly differently. So you can combine quite easily, well, with inverted commas, obviously, information coming from two different platforms and combine this information to act as if you had a humongous baseline. So basically what becomes the limit is the baseline between the two telescopes and not the size of your telescope itself. And the optic, it is definitely a very appealing concept. It's just having satellites with the accuracy required, and you can't combine this information after gathering the data. You have to do it live while you're gathering photons. You have to co-phase everything and make sure it interferes coherently. So actually it is, because of the difference of wavelengths and the frequencies involved, it's a wave. Of light, it's really, really hard to do. So not yet, I think, maybe in the future, but 20 years more like it. So if we want to be flying CubeSats, we need to bet on a technology that will actually work in the sort of near future. It won't deliver the same sort of resolution, but it's actually achievable for free-flying telescopes like that. There's a mission called LISA, but it's obviously a completely different area of application. That's for gravitational waves. But yeah, the technical challenge are quite high, so maybe in the future.
Nice. Could we also one day apply this deploying method to other, like, smaller satellites, nanosats and attosats, or non-imaging satellites.
That's a good question. Actually, I think that the important thing we want to sort of look at as well is scalability, and we were thinking more going bigger, because ESA has plans to have been looking at geostationary satellites to have good resolution on the ground from geo. So there you need a really big telescope. And obviously for astronomy, the bigger telescopes, the next generation after the James Webb. But in principle, there would be no reason why you can go smaller as well. It needs to be scalable in both dimensions. Picosats are really small, so having all the mechanisms in place there would be quite a challenge. We already think it's quite a challenge from going from the James Webb Space Telescope to CubeSats. But hopefully that will be demonstrated at some point in the future, and then we can think of which direction we want to go at, bigger or smaller. And there's fitting things in a small volume is always tricky. So that's why we're at the moment more inclined to think bigger, but there's really no reason why we couldn't. It is important to be scalable and not design. That's the beauty of the CubeSat standard being a bit standard. So you hope that can scale up quite nicely.
Nice. It sounds like there's a world of opportunity in the research to on both downscaling and upscaling.
I think there is, yeah.
Both dimensions. Yeah, imagine these, you know, these swarms of these CubeSats or PicoSats, you know, throughout the solar system on a lot of the nearby planets and imaging.
Well, it's yeah. I mean, our application at the moment is more looking down at Earth, so Earth observation. But obviously, as I said, I work at the astronomy technology sector, so we are interested in astronomy. That's our main business, and the exploration of the solar system is one of our main topics as well. So yeah, I think having CubeSats on extra solar system missions is interesting, and I think the deployment thing, the mechanism is also quite valuable, I think, because you can achieve the same volume, much higher image quality. So if you want to image Mars, for example, and understand the weather patterns there, then you can have this, for the same cost. Let's say you can put two satellites with deployable optics instead of one, and therefore have twice the coverage or twice the temporal coverage, which might be interesting if you're looking at weather patterns of Mars, for example. So yeah, there's quite a promising future ahead, I hope, on the exploration of planets and other solar objects.
That's very exciting. So what you just mentioned, that makes me think about if it would make sense and if it would be feasible beneficial if you could combine two CubeSats, dock them together in orbit and combine the apertures and mirrors potentially.
Yeah, as I said, there's lots of concepts actually that people are coming up with that, from very practical to utterly crazy, of a fleet of thousands of satellites free flying together to form a telescope, maybe one day, but it's not going to happen, probably not in our lifetime. One of the things, other concepts, so we sort of betting on the deployable things, but I'm not arguing at all that's the only idea out there that will work. Docking has become, I think there are a couple demonstration already of CubeSats docking. So they're flying and launched, and then they dock together and they form, at least docking, they didn't do something combined. I think it was just proving that they can dock with the accuracy required. And so indeed, you can imagine that you have two mirrors, and then you put two CubeSat together and you have twice the mirror surface. So yeah, I think that's a great idea, actually, docking multiple platforms. And you can imagine having a couple, and then 3 months later, sending a couple more, et cetera, and you gradually build your platform. So I do think it's a great idea. I think the only disadvantage for building a telescope is basically you're not saving anything, you're just sending the same thing in just little chunks. So you're not actually, at the end you're building that pretty big telescope. I don't see how you can actually benefit from, you can have the standard of CubeSat and you can sort of split it up in multiple launches, so you can piggyback on launches. But in the end, you still have to launch the full thing. So, pros and cons.
Yeah, it'll be indeed interesting to see how the field develops, over the next few decades. So it's around 1.3 kilograms per one unit, with an average CubeSat cost around 50,000 US to manufacture in the present day. This is from the first web page on Google.
Well, I think the mass is a bit negotiable depending on your launch provider. So it can be a bit higher than that if you're having heavy equipment. But typically, what limits is the volume, not so much the mass. But it's important to keep an eye on the mass, because you always have big optics tend to be heavy. But the cost, the cost is pretty, not that expensive, to be honest. And I think that's A lot of universities are actually developing and launching their own CubeSats. It's certainly affordable. Instead of, you know, James Webb Space Telescope costing billions and billions, and definitely not affordable for a university to do. But I think that's the beauty. So hopefully, if we can keep within these costs, then affordable for normal universities and small companies, that would be great. Obviously, yeah. We need to develop everything first. First thing first. Yes. We develop technology, so we'll see about the cost a bit later.
Yes. Yeah, it's indeed exciting the way the direction things are headed. Gives a lot of us hope and inspiration. Awesome. Thanks so much, Noah, for joining
us. Thank you very much,
Paul. It's very insightful, and we learned a lot.
Thank you very much.